My guest is Peter Foster. Peter Foster is the public policy editor at the Financial Times. Welcome back to the podcast, Peter.
Thanks, Paul.
Right, we're going to talk about the impact of Trump's return to the White House on the UK's relationship with the EU. And your public policy editor title also means that you are the FT's, not self-styled, but widely recognized leading expert on EUK relations. And of course, for many years, you were a journalist in Washington, D.C., where we first met. So you are particularly well qualified to talk about this. My opening question to you, Peter, is all this talk, obviously since the Trump victory, but in the past week or so, that it's time for the UK to make this kind of binary choice now. Where does your destiny lie with the US or the EU? Is that a bit too quick off the mark? And some of these arguments are slightly premature, to say the least.
Well, it's definitely quick off the mark in the sense that we just don't know what Trump is going to do. We know what he said he's going to do: 60% tariffs on China, a tariff wall of 10 or even 20% on all goods coming into the US. But how quickly that happens will depend what legal routes he uses, who does he finally appoint to the trade or treasury portfolio. Do we see a return of Bob Lighthizer, who is a real protectionist, or do we see somebody more mainstream? So I think that's the first point to make. We don't know how quickly this is going to happen, and we don't know the route it's going to happen. It could be, I'm not a legal expert, Paul, but reading around, there is a kind of emergency. He could try and declare an emergency using a piece of legislation in the States that could see tariffs imposed really quite quickly, first the back end of the first quarter, second quarter next year. But there are other routes that use, the existing Section 301 measures that will, as I understand it, take much longer. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is it binary? Well, we'll have to wait and see. Lord Peter Mandelson, former European Trade Commissioner, Blairite cabinet minister, says we should have our cake and eat it. We should
Right.
try and face both ways. Again, I don't think we know how easy that's going to be, because we just don't know how hard is Trump going to force the issue, going to make us choose between backing him on China or backing him on tariffs against Europe, for example. Are we going to be able to cut a sweetheart deal with Washington, duck and dive, do our own thing? I think that it depends on what Trump does again. And then the last point I would make is that the Remainers, the Leavers, the right, the left, they all hear and see what they want to see. So for the Remainers, it's a no-brainer. Finally, it's obvious we can't deal with America. Let's go and throw our chips in the European basket. And for the Leavers, let's get alongside Trump. Let's get Trump to finally finish the job of a proper separation from the Death Star in Brussels. And away we go. And as always, life is more complicated than that.
Well, you are getting carried away with yourself, Peter, so early in the morning. On a point of information, since this is becoming quickly turning into something of a tutorial, tariffs are on goods, right? Not on services. And the bulk of the UK's trade with the US is in the area of services. So, how big a deal would tariffs on goods for the UK economy be?
I think not a massive deal. Obviously, some sectors, autos, chemicals, machinery, that they would suffer. But obviously, our economy is services de dominated. There are still issues on services. What the ESG, the social governance. There's already a body of law coming up in the United States where, companies that trade in the UK following ESG requirement reporting rules, etc., are questioning. There's a legal question of whether they're meeting their fiduciary duties to maximize profit for shareholders. And I think one of the things we will see, and this is a longer term thing than just tariffs, one of the things we will see is potentially this quite strong divergence on green regulation, on supply chain due diligence, on carbon border taxes, etc., that will actually be quite tricky for investors and companies in the UK, which neither sits in the EU regulatory orbit or the US one. So I think services obviously are a separate category. They do protect the UK to some degree, but not entirely. And I think the other thing, talking to, I'm neither a lawyer nor an economist, but talking to economists, I think there is an issue where the tariffs have knock-on effects that reduce economic growth because they slow the rate at which interest rates get cut because they're fundamentally inflationary. And the UK is an economy, that has high levels of intermediate goods and therefore If tariffs raise prices on goods, on inputs, that raises prices, creates inflationary pressure, and is likely to slow economic growth in some of the modelling that's been done, for example, by NISA, the National Institute for Economic and Social Research. And I think from a very narrow UK perspective, Paul, that's bad news for a Chancellor who was already battling this idea that actually she spent all the money on our health and education departments, and there isn't much money left for the industrial strategy and the skill strategy and the building 1.5 million homes that was supposed to be part of the sort of supply side reboot in the UK. And that potentially complicates the fate of the Labour government in London.
Okay, well, let's develop a bit this binary argument, even if you don't necessarily subscribe to it. There are a number of personalities, as I said in the introduction, who have come out quite quickly. People like Kim Darroch, former UK ambassador to the United States, Pascal Lamy, former European Trade Commissioner and head of the WTO, World Trade Organization, Ivan Rogers, a former permanent representative to of the UK to the European Union, all saying it is a binary choice. The UK has to make a decision, the timing of which may be slightly up in the air. But to what extent do you think that has credibility, that kind of argumentation?
I'm a reporter, Paul. I'm not a crystal ball gazer. And I make two observations. The first one is that you could argue that Brexit was a very clear inflection point.
Right.
And essentially what we saw was inertia. We saw a lot of tough talk about diverging from the EU, about a new post-British trade settlement, etc. But actually, the British state, A, wasn't capable of resourcing the regulators and resourcing an industrial strategy and implementing an industrial strategy that might have made that happen. But B, it was just easier politically to sort of triangulate and do and stay in the middle. The current Labour government, as a point of fact, is essentially doing that with the EU relationship. Yes, it's going to have a security deal. Yes, it wants to have a veterinary deal, or it wants to have what it calls a reset. But the reset is still with those same red lines: no single market, no customs union, no free movement. And anybody who listens to your podcast will know that that is an incredibly self-limiting set of red lines. So while they talk about tearing down the barriers to trade, actually they're doing nothing of the sort. And so I would just make that first observation. When you look at British government, British politics, you don't see big dynamic strategic decision making. What you see is muddling through. And therefore, Kim Darroch, Ivan Rogers, they may well be right in theory. Whether that translates in practice to bold moves, I have my doubts. Secondly, the UK establishment, as you well know, is instinctively Atlanticist. There was this Blairite idea that we could be pro-European but Atlanticist at the same time. The security establishment is basically Atlanticist in its outlook. And therefore, I think there will be a real tug of love there. I think if you just look at the numbers strategically, if you look at our reliance on Chinese battery technology and solar, etc., for the EV transition, we're not in the same place as the United States. We can't create vertical indigenous manufacturing and supply chains. We don't have big lumps of money like the IRA or the CHIPS Act or the Green New Deal in the EU. And therefore, we can't behave in that way. The question, I think, which goes back to how where we started here, is just how hard Trump is going to force the issue and make it a binary choice. Because ultimately, that's going to be what determines this, I think.
You talk about muddling through. Do you think that the incoming administration, in the shape of Robert Lighthizer, the guy you mentioned, the potential new USTR and senior Trump supporting economists like Stephen Moore, saying you do have to make the choice? Do you think that they sense a vulnerability, an opportunity for them to force the issue from the US side?
Possibly, how much do they really care? You know,
Right.
remember when we get back to 2016 and Trump was best buddies with Orban and was going to drive a wedge between Europe. I think I'd echo something that others have said, the Ivan Rogers and the Kim Darroch. This is fundamentally about China.
Right.
If you look, think of Marco Rubio as Secretary of State. This is an administration that isn't trying to have mutual rise of great power, isn't trying to find a modus vivendi with China. It's trying to take China on. It sees, well, two things. It sees China as fundamentally a strategic threat in the way it's previously seen the Soviet Union, etc., a genuine challenge to Europe, to American geostrategic dominance. And I think, secondly, talking to people last week in Washington, I was struck by the contrast of them talking to people in London. There was a lot more complacency or a lot more sanguine thoughts in London than in Washington. And by talking to people in Washington, in the trade world and think tanks, there is a real sense that America feels it's been too open, its economy, it's been a free ride, it's been put upon, it sucks up all those Mercedes-Benzes, and there is a real sense that that's going to end. And so I'm cautioned and counseled by people in Washington not to underestimate, by whatever legal mechanism, Trump's determination to force through these tariffs and this approach to trade, this mechanic. Now, there are breaks that could come to that. There's inflationary pressures, there's price pressures that could put a brake on that. There's bits of Congress that might put a brake on that still. But I think there is a determination there, and that is going to make it choppy. Whether Nigel Farage can really convince Donald Trump to force the UK to choose, I'm just not sure that's quite how the world works.
Well, okay, so moving on from binary, the cakeism that we briefly mentioned, you quoted Peter Mandelson to that effect, but also he's not alone, Peter Mandelson. Andy Haldane, former Bank of England chief economist, has said something quite similar. I hope, he says, the government is in a position to really pat its head and rub its tummy at the moment, he said. So he told The Guardian, sorry to mention The Guardian on a podcast with an FT guy, but so it's not just Peter Mandelson flying kites, as he's apparently prone to do occasionally, but also senior people like respected commentators and economists like Haldane. You can have both.
No, indeed. And Keir Starmer this week is meeting Xi Jinping at the G20 in Rio de Janeiro, the first prime minister, British prime minister, have a meeting, I think, for 5 or 6 years. Lammy's been to Beijing. The Labour government in London wants to have a pragmatic investment relationship with China. That's clearly at odds with where Trump's heading. And so I think it's going to be challenging. Let's take, for example, this question about tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles. The EU has those tariffs. The UK has decided not to. We have two battery, one big battery factory, the Envision factory that's attached to the Nissan plant in Sunderland. That's Chinese technology. Bridgewater, a new battery factory coming on. It's going to use Tata's Indian technology when it's ready. But before that, I understand from my car correspondent colleagues, it's going to be Chinese technology. The UK can't really afford to pick a massive fight with China. The trouble comes when Washington sort of makes that a good faith test. I would also say that there's a talking to people last week, something that I hadn't sort of really fully appreciated. But when you think about it, we think of Trump, he'll find a legal mechanism. And I think my colleagues in DC say that, pretty much he'll find a way to do what he wants to do. But the European Union and the UK are still keen to follow the rules, what's left of the global trade rules. And the British government can't just slap tariffs on Chinese EVs. It needs to find a complainant who is showing that they have injury
Damage,
as a
yeah.
result of, yeah. And it's not just and maybe well be that if Peter Mandelson is the ambassador, he'll have to explain to the court of Trump that it's not quite as easy as, why hasn't that goddamn Keir Starmer put tariffs on Chinese EVs? Well, he has to go through a process, and it's not clear that. And so I think all of that is just going to be more complicated than the knockabout commentary appreciates.
Bring it back then to the UK context, and as you say, these red lines, which of the current government, which seem pretty indistinguishable from red lines of the previous Conservative government. We've seen for the past 3 or 4 months the same omerta that existed before the general election in Britain, the effect that nobody really talks about Brexit, nobody in positions of authority, certainly not publicly. And give me your take on this, and don't accuse me of being naive and or over optimistic. At last week's Mansion House event, where the great and the good of the financial world come together, where Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor Exchequer, made obviously a keynote address, but also the Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, said the following, quote, "As a public official, I take no position on Brexit per se. That's important, but I do have to point out consequences. The changing trading relationship with the EU has weighed on the level of potential supply. The impact on trade seems to be more in goods and services. That is not particularly surprising to my mind, but it underlines why we must be alert to and welcome opportunities to rebuild relations while respecting the decision of the British people," end of quote. What is your take on Mr. Bailey's comment?
I thought it was a rebuke to the Labour government. I'm not sure it was reported that way, Paul, but I think when the chair, when the governor of the Bank of England says that, what he's saying is, we might not want to talk about it, but Brexit is damaging the UK as an investment proposition, and it's damaging our trade, just as the OBR said it would. 15% long run hit imports and exports, 4% smaller economy than otherwise would have been. I think people wrongly read that as some kind of pincer movement with Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, who also acknowledged the damage Brexit was doing in her Mansion House speech. But actually, the truth is, this Labour government, with its red lines, as we were saying, is really talking about status quo with whatever mitigations it can get. And we're going to have this reset. It's first and foremost going to be about a security deal, which we might get before Christmas or shortly after Christmas. And then there's going to be a summit. But what's on the table is very, very limited. A veterinary deal, and still no agreement whether the UK can accept a dynamically aligned veterinary deal. But even so, we had Liam Byrne, the chair of the Business and Trade Committee, saying the big prize here is a veterinary deal. Well, it's useful for UK food and drink exporters, use case, but like, let's not kid ourselves that a veterinary deal is macroeconomically a game changer. It isn't. And I think the other bit that they've mentioned, MRPQs, well, we know, nine rounds of
Mutual
negotiation.
recognition of professional qualifications.
Thank you. Which, if you don't have a mobility deal, is of limited use anyway. And secondly, there's provision for that in the TCA. There's provision for that in the Canada deal. We know nine rounds of negotiations to get a deal on architects for the Canadians. And actually, when the UK tried to get a deal under the Tories for our architects, the Commission rejected it because it found the UK's proposal unacceptable. So let's not kid ourselves that that door is going to suddenly flow open. We know we've got the French fishing. What I'm saying is that actually, what has not happened here. I know there's one or two member states saying rather darkly, do we even call this a reset? There hasn't been a fundamental attempt to actually reset the conversation. It feels to me very like 2017, the British government, now Labour, before Tory, working out internally what it could do, what it could agree to on things like carbon border taxes, on whether we can have a youth mobility deal, different factions in the Labour government fighting. While that's going on, in Brussels, the Commission's running its seminars for member states, locking down the red lines on its files. Now, that's the kind of iterative negotiation that might lead to a bit of shaving off this, that, and the other. It's not going to be transformational. The question is whether what happens in Ukraine under Donald Trump, what happens when Scholz leaves and we get Merz, presumably, likely as a new German chancellor with a different approach to the debt brake, etc., whether there is a kind of moment there that gives the British government political cover to be more ambitious, genuinely more ambitious with the reset. And I think there is probably a moment if they're minded to take it. Maybe we'll look back at Rachel Reeves' Mansion House speech 2024 and go, that was the moment they actually realised they've got to be bolder. I genuinely don't know whether that's where this is headed. And I don't think they do, because they still don't know, of course, what Trump's going to do.
For people listening to this who are maybe not following it, these things closely as you and I, they're probably still rather bemused and find it perplexing the stance of the Labour government on EU-UK relations. And of course, it's historically been framed in terms of, well, we don't want to lose the famous Red Wall.
I think if you are negative about the prospects for a reset with the EU, we know that we need some kind of mobility agreement, youth mobility deal, well, you could call it something else, but ultimately some kind of mobility agreement. If the strategy of the Labour government is to get re-elected in 2029 by pumping a load of money into the health service, money into education, and cutting net migration significantly, all the while mindful that in a lot of those Red Wall seats, they were assisted in winning by the Reform Party, by Nigel Farage's latest vehicle, which split the Tory vote, then it seems unlikely that the internal argument for a youth mobility deal is going to be won by those who are in favour, it seems to me. There was some information that The Guardian got, I think by Freedom of Information, which showed that there were 23,000 people who used the UK's other youth mobility deals, which are very different from what the Commission is proposing, but we have them with Australia and Taiwan and Japan and Samoa and various places. And you have to have £5,000, you have to pay the NHS surcharge, you can get a visa, it's 2 years, 18 to 30-year-old. There's quotas in some cases, some countries, but it was 23,000 that came. So if you did a youth mobility deal with the EU, 27 countries on your doorstep, How many people might come? I mean, very difficult to know. We
Yeah.
know that when we didn't take transition controls on free movement, many more people came than was expected. The dynamics are different now. If it was 5,000 per country, that would be 135,000. That's probably too many if you're looking at the net migration statistics and you want to really show they'll come down. If you're bolder, you say, well, they were super inflated, those statistics, anyway, because of Ukraine and Hong Kong, etc. They're going to come down naturally. They will be coming down. Let's be a little bit braver. Hitherto, this is not a government that's been marked itself out by bravery, you know,
Well,
and the internal political conversation, I think, to me, and I speak as a policy editor, and I defer to my colleagues who cover politics full time, but it doesn't feel to me like that's an area where they are not nervous, put it that way.
whether it's bravery or boldness or whatever. Well, final question then, Peter, to wrap this up. You've mentioned a number of times the famous reset. It seems increasingly that this strategy, if you can call it a strategy, has many holes in it. The people to whom it's addressed are more and more suspicious and cynical about the whole process, as you know. I'm just wondering, my final question to you is, to what extent do you think the government itself is conscious that this reset, quote unquote, strategy is increasingly lacking credibility?
I think they are. I think, like a lot of things with this government, they wanted more time and they feel that they're getting their ducks in a row ahead of hopefully this security strategy coming out maybe before Christmas, maybe soon after Christmas. They're getting their ducks in a row ahead of a summit in the maybe in March, April next year, first quarter, beginning of second quarter, we hear, and then this negotiation can begin. And they feel they ought to be doing that. I would say, as an outsider, whilst they're doing that, they're losing the narrative and they're not really building momentum. And they're not really making it seem to the European side like they actually want something that is worth the Europeans getting out of bed for or pushing the boat out for. And obviously, they've done this bilateral deal with Germany and they're going to have a security pact. But what we need to do is really think strategically about where we have big areas of common interest, you know, things like electricity trading, where we're all trying to get to net zero at the same time. You know, there is interest in professional mobility, you know, and we can start with things like apprenticeship exchanges and what have you. But I think something which really shows that we want to be part of the plan, and then that's more likely that you're going to overcome objections, obviously led by the French as always, who want to, you know, do want to keep it very, very narrow. But you can't really blame, I think, the European side for keeping it narrow, because that's all the messaging they, as far as I can see, they seem to be getting from the European side, which is every time they open their mouth, they start with no single market, no customs union, no free movement. And they're, you know, but we want a big, bold reset. I'm going to build up that wall, and I'm going to keep to all the rules that built the wall, but I'm going to promise to smash the wall down. It's nonsense. You know,
Well,
and I think people felt it last week, actually, when Reeves came out and said what she said after what Bailey had said. People on the kind of pro-European side, come on, for goodness sake, let's move on, really felt it. I would just say that Labour MPs, I don't think, are going back to their constituencies on a Friday and being berated by their constituents to go and do more for Europe, go and do more for immigration. You know, those real political drivers domestically are not there. Who knows? Trump could provide them. But as things stand, domestically, it's really interesting to me that actually both main political parties really would rather not talk about it. It's too complicated. The blowback is too complicated.
right. Well, on that relatively somber note, Peter Foster, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.